Welcome to the Nip Tuck Coach Radio, your cosmetic surgery connection. Join cosmetic surgery Nip Tuck Coach, beauty expert, and author of Safety First, A Consumer Guide to Cosmetic Surgery, Michelle Garber, your host of the Nip Tuck Radio Show. Michelle's goal is to empower listeners and help them make safe cosmetic surgery procedure choices. This fun and lively show explores the world of beauty and cosmetic surgery and features expert guests on a variety of topics. No hype. Your host, Michelle Garber, is here today to help you navigate the confusing world of cosmetic surgery.
Hi, everyone. This is Michelle Garber, your host, and we're broadcasting live this afternoon from beautiful San Francisco. And happy Valentine's Day and TGIF. If you don't know me, I'm founder of Nip Tuck Coach, an independent cosmetic procedure consultancy, and I'm a patient advocate. My goal is to help you navigate the confusing world of cosmetic procedures by keeping you safe and well-informed so that not only do you get a great result, but you get the best result. And to create more consumer awareness for safety and beauty, I've written a comprehensive guide called Safety First, The 10 Golden Rules for Safe Cosmetic Surgery, and you can download that for free at my website, which is www.niptuckcoach.com. So now that we're entering Valentine's Day tomorrow, I notice that there's a lot of promotions from plastic surgeons and dermatologists and many spas on lip plumping. So lip plumping is very popular. And I think that when we think about lip plumping, we also forget about our aesthetic smile. You know, our smile is part of our face, and having your lips plumped, if you don't have nice teeth, is really not going to be the overall look that you're going for. So I think it's important that we talk a little bit about what is a healthy smile, a beautiful smile, an aesthetic smile. How does your overall health affect your teeth? And with us this afternoon, I have from Washington, Dr. Claudia Kotka, an international lecturer and aesthetic restorative dentist, and she's founder of the Washington Institute for Dentistry and Laser Surgery. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
How are you?
Thank you so much for, wonderful, thank you so much for having me on the show. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time out to be with us. Dr. Kotka, for more than a decade, has developed customized dental protocols on full mouth restorative dentistry, lasers, implants, dental anti-aging, and whitening therapies. She's held memberships with the Academy of General Dentistry, American Society of Laser and Medical Surgery, International Team for Implantology, and many others. She's appeared on online portals, CyrusXM, Doctors Radio, NBC News, and frequently on NBC News as dental and oral health expert. So let's talk a little bit about the aging face and how our teeth age or our bone structure ages. Can you bring us through the process from our 20s leading up to our 60s and what happens to our mouth and our smile?
Sure. So by and large, you know, the way we present from day to day obviously is affected by the genetics and what type of genes we inherit, of course, from generations before. And so depending on the asymmetries or the imbalances of how those genetic formulations, for instance, present, the aging process for each individual will be customized and can be much more progressive or can be much more friendlier, if you will, or what we call aging gracefully. By and large, ranging from the teens to the 20s and onward, when we have an imbalance, and we'll start from the face, coordinates in three dimensions, of course, it's all ported and it starts by the skeletal system. Then we have, of course, the muscles and the neurological, the nerve bundles that, of course, influence those muscles, as well as the teeth as they erupt throughout the teen and going into the 20s, 30s, and 40s. Those eruption potentials are going to essentially keep our bites, our jaw, jaws in a fixed position. Now, with time, majority of the development, of course, occurs in the early up to the 20s, but there's some development in terms of changes, slight nuances depending on what the imbalances that have been tolerated that far. Particularly, for instance, if there's spaces involved, we can expect further movement. Particularly if there's an underlying systemic condition, of course, we can also expect changes with respect to the neurological response, the underlying bone structures, which obviously support the teeth, and the force overload of the bite during chewing and speaking, and also reactive mechanisms to stress or other variables will have a very profound impact on how the teeth will wear with time. Particularly, we're looking for chipping, damage to the teeth, fractures, for instance. And once treatment is started in the oral health aspect for either functional reconstructions or aesthetics, then we have to also bear the consequences of the options related to those particular treatments, because not all treatments are, of course, equal. Some treatments require much more maintenance than other treatments. And so that contributes to the larger picture in terms of the progression from age.
So what I hear you saying is that one thing we have genetics, and some of us may be more predisposed to dental issues than others. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
And also the way our teeth are aligned. So if an individual has braces at a young age and the teeth are aligned correctly, as they age, are they going to be better off in their overall dental health than if their teeth were not aligned properly?
Yes, very good question, Michelle. So for obvious reasons, and of course science supports this, the physics of the position of the teeth, of course, has a significant impact on the aging process. So when we have teeth that are aligned, first of all, we have better access to clean them. Second of all, of course, they will have a tendency to bear load, if you will, during chewing and functioning much more evenly, as opposed to one particular tooth bearing more load or an uneven load than the other. But just because, for instance, a arch is aligned, in within the bone, doesn't necessarily mean that the entire facial, skeletal, and dental system, you know, coincides as effectively as it could. And for that reason, we certainly have interdisciplinary treatment planning and diagnosis that involves facial surgery, jaw surgery, to allow treatment base that is much more friendlier with time. So sometimes, for instance, in hopes of compensating for skeletal deficiencies or unevenness, sometimes we hope that the teeth can really, you know, be moved in a certain ways and certain angles. But in certain situations, that may not be as optimal as, of course, involving jaw surgery, which would more appropriately delineate a more stable, configured aging with time.
So what are some, for jaw surgery, what are some of the reasons why an individual may find that jaw surgery is necessary?
So when we have, for instance, deficiencies where the lower jaw is certainly not aligned appropriately in a vertical dimension as well as horizontal dimension with respect to the upper jaw, the teeth would naturally try to compensate for chewing up, you know, for purposes of chewing. And our bodies actually have an inherent system within it to actually help heal itself. And our bodies are actually made that way. And it's a very fascinating complex that you see a response. When deficiency is too great and therefore would result in flaring the teeth too excessively, you know, for that closure to occur, so that, you know, the teeth would obviously be in contact for chewing purposes, that is where a more appropriate recommendation in terms of having jaw surgery, advancing the jaw, where we make a cut in on both sides of the jaw, and we would advance it appropriately so it matches with not only the upper jaw, but also configured within the joint dimensions as well. So that would be one example where that might be appropriate.
So now that's interesting when we think about facelift patients. Do you work in
Yes.
conjunction with plastic surgeons when a patient comes in and is interested in a facelift and then possibility a chin implant, and then we have to look at the profile view? How do you work with plastic surgeons?
So a very fascinating collaboration. I find the interdisciplinary aspect of looking at the smile reconstruction within the facial domain as very unique and appropriate. You know, a chin implant, for instance, would be the prime examples where, you know, there might be, for instance, jaw deficiencies, and we're speaking here about the lower jaw. In evaluating the supporting structures, you know, starting from the muscle complex and the soft tissue, of course, we have to always remember there's a skeletal underlying structure that supports everything. And with time, that neurological muscle complex also kicks in and essentially follows a behavioral mechanism that is repeated from day to day without even us thinking twice about it. So in my discussions with patients that are seeking a facial reconstruction, and my discussion with plastic surgeons, it's appropriate to identify where the deficiencies lie. And of course, I tend to find that results that are optimal, not just functionally but aesthetically, tend to be more stable with time when they are, of course, targeting the etiologic origin of deficiency. So when we're targeting where is the problem starting, I find that the results of those options of treatment tend to be much more natural and, of course, much more effective.
That's interesting, working with the plastic surgeon, and because our jawline is such an important aspect of how we age, and that's one place that you see right away the aging process with the jowls and the neck, and chin implants have been very popular over the years. And so I can see how that would make sense working with the plastic surgeon. If there's anything really going on with the bone structure and the teeth, I would think that would need to be addressed probably first.
Yes, and I think, of course, there are always, you know, with every surgery, with every treatment option, there's positives and also risks involved, and, you know, both aspects have to be considered. But when we're speaking about, you know, advancing a lower jaw, for instance, in the case of a deficiency, a chin implant, you know, might, you know, certainly be part of the option or the solution. However, if we were to look more comprehensively, perhaps, and just step back and evaluate the coordinates of the face and the optimal ratios, particularly even sometimes looking at the joints and how the joints themselves trace and where they position. You know, I mentioned earlier that our bodies always want to compensate deficiency, and that's very true. Our bodies learn to just put up with things that, you know, that become abnormal for one reason or another. But as we age as well, those variables just start to layer. And so as we age, we tend to find that we've hit sometimes our threshold, you know, and we all do that in various different segments of our livelihood, depending, of course, starting from the genomics that I mentioned earlier.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about the effect of bone loss and loss of volume in the face. You know, a lot of people use fillers, including myself, and there is bone loss around the perioral area. How does that integrate with the bone loss of the teeth and the facial fillers, and what are some treatments? I mean, how do we work with that with that part of our aging process of our face.
Mm-hmm. So when we're speaking about bone loss, of course we are assuming that there's been some kind of bone loss around the tooth structure overall. And as that occurs, of course, the teeth are no longer as stable as they were once because there's less bone. Not only, for instance, quantity, but also we have to remind ourselves there might be some quality compromise as well. As the bone depletes itself and the teeth become somewhat perhaps more mobile or, much more sensitive, let's say, they give in a little bit more. Under excessive pressures, for instance, from clenching, grinding, and there's a segment of population that is quite actually predominant in our day and age, even I think some studies quote as high as 60% to 80% in metropolitan areas. Having that variable, in addition to some bone loss, which of course would we are very well aware, particularly reside in women, would translate with time to what we call in dentistry a loss of vertical dimension. And what I mean by that, if you were to take a measure of point A to point B, which point A is somewhat, for instance, near the nose, let's say, and point B and the other, of course, extreme is at the chin, as you age in the context of bone loss and some modification at the tooth structure, you see that vertical height just ever so slightly decreasing. Now, as that occurs with time, neurologically and from a muscle perspective, there are accommodations being made at the joint level as well as at the neuromuscular level to allow for that and to adapt to that. And so now we, of course, are speaking about functional aspects, but the functional, of course, always, in my professional opinion, I have seen it to affect the aesthetics. So when I look
right.
at aesthetics, I always have to consider the functional coordinates to see where we are now and where we need to be. So going back to looking at treating loss of volume in the face, the bone loss component, both quality and quantity, becomes quite relevant for a vertical loss situation where increasing back that vertical would tend to help the system rehabilitate to where it was once before. And so
what are some of the treatments
to different.
And what are
yes.
some of those treatments?
So some of the treatments would be, for instance, to add, to do an evaluation where the bite is existing and to compensate with additional materials. And these days we have fantastic biomaterials where they can be very thin layers where we don't have to reduce a lot of natural tooth structure that's perfectly healthy. And with the use of appropriate adhesive protocols, which are technique sensitive, but a lot of us are very comfortable with, we can increase the vertical dimension to be more toward the baseline level where it was once upon a time. All, of course, we are assuming that we have addressed the bone loss. We have, of course, addressed the origin of what caused that particular bone loss. And when in the context of discussing periodontitis, which is sometimes erroneously referred to or unfairly referred to as a gum disease, it obviously involves the bone. When
right.
With that condition being addressed, of course, we have to, we do have options to rehabilitate that vertical dimension with dental treatment or dental reconstruction and obtain back the deficiency that we have lost. Now,
so when you're talking about building
mind,
up the teeth, are you referring to porcelain
mm-hmm.
veneers?
I'm referring, yes, or onlays or inlays. So if you can imagine, I'd like to just broaden perhaps your view and refer to whatever surface is necessary in whatever three-dimensional configuration that's customized by the technician, a master dental technician, and myself to allow for that vertical dimension to be where it was once upon a time.
So it's a combination of porcelain veneers and inlays and onlays. Would you, for our audience, explain what the difference is?
Yes. So when we refer to, for instance, crowns, inlays, onlays, veneers, all those references are made to different shapes of biomaterials, in this particular case porcelain, based on the exact volume of deficiency is. So if, for instance, happens to be the surface missing or where we have to add happens in the front of a tooth, we tend to call that a jacket or some has been commonly referred to, or more appropriately the nomenclature is a veneer. When the missing structure is from the bite aspect, from the flatness of view of a tooth, if you will, that is referred to as an onlay or an inlay. Of course, when we have to get more aggressive and remove more structure, that has been traditionally referred to as a crown. As aesthetic restorative dentists, myself included, we can be very customized in terms of where we remove tooth structure and how much we remove. I tend to be as conservative as possible, all in the hopes of maintaining perfectly good tooth structure that doesn't have to be touched by, of course, compensating with much more technology advanced materials that allow me to become, to have very, very thin structures and have that glued on, if you will, to the remaining tooth structure.
So how has, you just mentioned technologically advanced materials, how has that evolved over the years?
Mm-hmm. Very good question. So, you know, a decade or, you know, to, you know, have basically your typical porcelain, which was 100% glass. But since we have, the industry has given us, and the science has given us many other options, which include filler materials and filler particles, which now makes the ceramic structure much more stronger. And of course, with properties that allow for a greater bonding to the enamel portion of a tooth, which is the outer surface of the tooth. Usually anywhere between 1 to 2 millimeters of, on average, of our teeth is made of enamel. That surface is very important for adhesive dentistry. And traditionally, our technologies, because the biomaterials we used to work with could not bear, thinness less than a millimeter and a half. Now these days, and the science today, give us that opportunity. So when that occurs, of course, it translates into having to remove less tooth structure during the preparation phase so that we can restore the tooth.
So let's talk a minute what the difference is now between, you mentioned fillers, and now we're not talking about facial fillers for volume. We're talking about fillers for teeth. Let's make that clear.
Yes.
What is the difference between the fillers or composites and the porcelain veneers, and when would you use a filler versus a porcelain veneer?
Mm-hmm. So when I mentioned fillers before, those fillers, of course, vary by characteristics and composition. And so we have two categories. We have the plastics, which are referred to as white fillings, or they're referred to, for instance, as composite resins. Those fillers range anywhere from nanoparticles to much more robust, different variations of grain sizes, if you will. And the larger the grain size, of course, the stronger the material. And when we have clinically present a volume of deficiency, I would say, you know, less than 20 to 30% of the tooth structure, a plastic restoration is appropriate and will bear the load somewhat, similarly to the root, to the tooth structure itself under force and under load during day-to-day use. And so the longevity of the restoration can be counted out by and large. Now, when we are speaking about larger volume defects in tooth structure that perhaps range more than 40 to 50% of the actual tooth structure, we have to consider biomaterials that are more in range and in elasticity and in the characteristics that are similar to our tooth structure and that can flex and also can bear load. So starting from the glass that I mentioned, 100% glass ceramics, which we used to have, the filler particles and different compositions that we now have on the market have allowed to actually increase double and triple the amount of load that even a natural tooth structure can bear, even up to 5 or 6 times more. And I'll give you an example. A material which became available to the market, trade names as Emax, is a wonderful material in that it represents a much stronger load than your general 100% glass ceramic material. And at the same time, it's able to covalently bond, and that means glue directly to the tooth structure. And that gives a really, really fantastic composition to our teeth to bear load with time and also not have a play or not have a degluing process, if you will, under load as it ages. So, for instance, in my own mouth, I've had inlays, onlays made of this material, and I've had them for at least 10 to 12 years, if not more. Now, some of the newer material on the market have become, particularly crowns and some veneers, are made of zirconia or layered with zirconia and an underlying substrate. Zirconia is a completely different characteristic of a biomaterial compared to 100% glass, which is ceramic, versus the Emax I just mentioned. And so also it's very difficult to actually bond zirconia. So when we consider a minimally invasive restoration or whatever the composition or the presentation of the tooth structure is, you have to also bear in mind the biomaterials available and, of course, how we can optimize the wear patterns with time. And the more stable materials, of course, as I mentioned, would be dependent on both mechanical aspects of retaining the restoration. For instance, in this case, zirconia would have to have a mechanical resistance, whereas Emax, for instance, can certainly bond without having to have the mechanical resistance pattern in the preparation phase. So I know this is rather technical, but in the end, some of the biomaterials give us capabilities to be much more minimally invasive than others.
So it sounds like it's really important to have a customized approach depending on what your needs are and what you're trying to achieve. That's what I'm hearing, because you have so many different materials to use that it really depends on the patient and what the patient's needs are. And by load, you're referring to the way a patient's teeth grind or chew. Is that what you're referring to?
That is correct. You're right on point. Yes, you're right on point, Michelle.
Now, speaking about chewing and load, I know a lot of people grind their teeth and clench their teeth. And my understanding is that that also tends to loosen the teeth and can promote some bone loss. Is that correct?
Yes, so the research has indicated that, for instance, in the presence of periodontitis, or what I referred to earlier, aka as gum disease, in the presence of bone loss and tooth mobility, or no tooth mobility, but just having the presence of history of periodontitis, clenching and grinding will actually exacerbate the periodontitis synergistically. So it is much more of a profound effect on bone loss and the rate of bone loss when we have both the presence of periodontitis and clenching and grinding.
And what are some treatments for this?
so we start, of course, we have to address it from two different perspectives. And one is we have to address the etiologic cause of periodontitis. Part of that has some implications into the genes and what we inherit, of course. The periodontal treatments have to take that in consideration. And so we target the type of bacteria present, the concentration of bacteria, where these pockets are. And then we of course have to measure the results after a month, and at the same time we have to parallel that treatment with the addressing the clenching, the grinding, so that we can ease off the load while we are trying to address the microbial presence, and at the same time promote bone restoration. So if you can imagine, if you have a tooth that's loose within an area of a bone that's trying to heal and become more robust, it's going to be much more harder for that area to heal proactively if that tooth is constantly being moved by external forces.
So what are some of the guards? I know there's night guards, and there's ones that you can get made at the dentist's office that are customized, and then there's ones that you can buy over the counter. What are the differences? What do you recommend?
There are many, many, many differences, and the difference is precisely how the guard is made, in terms of not only does it fit appropriately over the teeth, and of course has to cover equally all the teeth in that particular arch, which is key. But at the same time, it's the key is the interaction that it has with the opposing arch. So over-the-counter guard, for instance, I know that it seems to be a great idea. However, some of the studies have already shown that those particular guards, because they're not under the care of a specialist in the area of dentistry, can certainly profoundly exacerbate and makes the matter worse in terms of the clenching and the grinding. These days, we have see a lot more cases that involve clenching grinders with the sleep apnea, the obstructive sleep apnea effect. And so that brings me to answer the question the second question, or the second part of your question, which is how do we really differentiate which appliance is for me? And if you can imagine, just like, for instance, we have prescriptions for eyeglasses, I tend to use this analogy, it is important to have the right prescription for the guard itself. My experience with a variety of patients, ranging from mild and preventative scenarios to much more chronic and previously tried and failed treatment options, I tend to prefer customized guards that I make myself, of course, based on the data collection, as well as formulating a treatment plan that translates into results-driven protocols.
So you definitely recommend then going to see your dentist for a customized guard versus then ones over the counter. That can do more harm than good is what I hear you saying.
Yes, of course. Unfortunately, if it would be really that easy, you know, we wouldn't have to, I think, have the extra training and the knowledge base. And, you know, sometimes perhaps, you know, for maybe a short amount of time, results may be seen as positive. But, you know, no one's really able to say for sure, how that translates with time in terms of the liability. So, you know, oftentimes in my practice, when patients seek me out, you know, they come in already with a Ziploc bag of, you know, previous appliances that have failed. And so that to me states that, you know, of course, and based on the, how I customize my guards and appliances, indicates that it's not it's quite a complex formulation, and it goes well beyond just the tooth position. It takes in consideration, as I said, the face and the whole dental facial system and the underlying systemic contributions to that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I recently I had a night guard made, maybe about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, and I recently switched mm-hmm. dentists, and I brought the night guard to the dentist, and he took a look at it and put it in my mouth, and he said, "Well, this is really a waste of an appliance." What he was basically saying was that it wasn't made the way he thinks it should be done, and that it wasn't doing what it was supposed to be doing. So that was interesting. So that's two different opinions by two professionals, and so now I'm going to have a new one made, and we'll see how that one works. And those things happen. So let's talk a little bit. I do want to talk a little bit about teeth whitening, since that's always a hot subject, and everyone wants very white teeth, and sometimes I see teeth that look a little bit too white. And mm-hmm. there's over the counters, there's an office, there's take home, there's trays, and you also do a laser treatment in your office, I believe, called microabrasion to get rid of some stains.
The laser treatment is separate from the microdental abrasion, which you're referring to. So they're two different separate techniques.
What exactly is microabrasion? Let's start with that.
So microdental abrasion is a technique that has actually been on the market for quite a number of years, even decades, where essentially particles are used to somewhat remove the roughness or the unevenness of the very superficial layer of a tooth structure, or not even the tooth structure, but rather the pedicle and the biofilm, which is the layer that we don't see necessarily on our teeth, made of bacteria and proteins and whatnot, which of course holds a lot of the stains that we don't like. So with the microdental abrasion, of course, it's all about the packaging, what type of particles I have in my preparation, and how I apply it. I tend to use it quite infrequently. When I do, is by case only. And of course, the technique has to be very particular to ensure that it's not invoking damage on the surface to a greater extent that I expect, while removing just the biofilm. So I like to stay very superficial with it, you know, less than 30 seconds, and it's done in conjunction as well with other procedures that are targeting revitalizing the tooth structure and reinforcing that tooth structure.
So you talk about revitalizing and reinforcing the tooth structure, and I know that some of these whitening gels start to eat away at the enamel. Am I correct in that?
Yes.
It's good to. So how do we put back the enamel? I know some of the whitening gels have another gel that you put over after you've whitened your teeth to help revitalize back the enamel.
Mm-hmm. So this is a very this is a science question, and I start with the comment that you made just a second ago, which was the gel itself eats away at the surface. The appropriate, I would say, mechanism of whitening that I adhere to tends to reflect the perception, or at least what we know as scientists in the discipline, as almost removing stains within the tubule of the tooth structure. So if you can imagine, the tooth surface itself has pores, much like our skin do, but these pores are very regular. And within those pores, there's bacteria and, of course, debris from your lunch, dinner, drinks, espresso, etc. So, when I treat, of course, a stained surface. First of all, I look to see if there's any sort of granules or deposits on the tooth structure, and that may be in the form of tartar. Tartar has many different ways of presenting itself on tooth structures. It can be ledges, which is very visible, but it can also come in very granularized forms. And once that that aspect is addressed, then I of course take a look to see which whitening composition is best suited for that particular surface. In terms of revitalizing tooth structure, the verdict on that science is still out. There are many. We know that there are formulations like the MI paste, like the calcium phosphate compositions, fluoride, for instance, which specifically latch on to the internal chemistry, if you will, of these tubules I mentioned, and really fortify the tooth structure such that when bacteria or other things want to deposit or infiltrate, that surface is almost a pH of a unit stronger, vis-a-vis acid or anything that would destroy or melt down that particular spot. So sometimes, for instance, so much that I have to separate the application of whitening versus gels or nutrients like fluoride, for instance, because I want to ensure that my whitening gel and composition has access to the distaining globule, if you will, or bundle, and it's not stopped by my fluoride that has just reinforced my tooth structure. So I think there is something to be said that is wise about the sequencing of events when you're dealing with distaining a tooth structure. Sometimes I use the analogy of using very sensitive materials, like for instance silks, etc. We don't clean a silk surface the same way we clean a cotton surface, and we differentiate between the fibers and the pores, etc. And so take that a little bit further to apply in the same way to the tooth structure, and we have to, I think, observe that when I do that, my results are quite different than the other alternatives present. Now, in terms
so
of...
So, again, it sounds like you customize your whitening treatments according to what the patient's teeth actually look like and what they need, whether it be take-home trays for the patient or whether it be an in-office laser treatment. Am I correct in that?
Yes. Very much, very much. And just to add one thing, I know we are very, we've heard a lot about the strips that, are over the counter.
Yes, press white strips.
Sometimes having a particular dose, even though it might be a lower dose, but if it's applied too frequently, it may invoke a certain response that is not necessarily a positive response. Not only that, one of the limitations I see with those strips is that the distribution of the gel is not even throughout the surface. So oftentimes patients who seek my whitening treatment, particularly mention that, sure, okay, this structure here, I see that it's white, but I've got this halo of yellow all around. And when you look at the smile, that has a presence, because the unevenness in the whitening, if you will, or destaining, has a visual cue that gives, somewhat only a significant improvement, and not which may not be complete. In particular, the impact of the gels, some of the whitening gels, for instance, particularly that you obtain as a dentist, as well as that are done in the office, have certain stronger concentrations. And as a toxicologist, I like to be very, very careful with what I apply where and for how long. So when we speak of toxicity and impact on the surface of a structure, of tooth structure, making it rough, for instance, that's considered a toxic impact, of course. We have to understand what is the dose that particular effect is observed, and also what is the delivery mechanism. So in my professional opinion, Crest strips or any other strips that are over the counter are not to be used indefinitely and are not to be used, you know, in terms of, you know, removing stains, you know, with continued care.
Can they be used as a quick fix?
Well, a quick fix for a very small amount of time, for a limited time.
Okay.
But
you think it's safe to use for a quick fix?
Yes, of course it is. But, the quick fix may not, of course, be may not correlate with the expected results that have been observed with other treatments. That is the reason why I promote and I support fully destaining a tooth surface and then, of course, maintaining that, because that allows for the appropriate removal of the stain, getting the results you want and are appropriate in a safe modality, and then maintaining that over time without having to do a retreatment.
What do you like better? Do you like the in-office treatment, the laser, or the take-home customized trays?
So that's a wonderful question. I customize everything, actually, for my patients. Sometimes I actually have European patients that say to me, Dr. Kotka, I want this type of whitening or this type of yellow hue. I don't want you to go further than that. So I tend to, of course, I have multiple systems in my office, more than, you know, than 10 different systems, and I customize those based on the results that my patients expect, within, of course, the limitations of their own clinical findings. But, you know, as I said, there are ways to detract stain and obtain the stain out and see that whitening effect, much like, you know, you can, for instance, take a piece of, a beautiful dress to your best dry cleaning outlet versus throwing it in the laundry and then stopping the cycle midway and expecting that you're going to get the same results.
Right, right. And then some teeth are very gray, and it's difficult to actually whiten them.
Well, that I've heard that before. However, in my practice, again, I think we're referring here to a common condition called tetracycline staining, and there's some other rare conditions that also can certainly influence that type of a clinical presentation. But we've done very successful whitening treatments even for tetracycline staining at Washington Institute for Dentistry and Laser Surgery. So I'd have to say that, I think it relates to the customization of the protocol based on the findings and the diagnosis.
And what about, going on to a different subject, on your website I saw you had something called tongue ties. What do you mean by tongue ties?
So very good question. Tongue ties.
Tongue ties.
Clinical presentation. Yes. Tongue ties is
not tongue tired. It's tongue ties, right?
Yes, tongue ties. Exactly. So it's a clinical presentation where the tongue itself is connected too close to the floor of the mouth, and there's a frenum there of course, and it varies from case to case. Sometimes the limitation is not as profound, but sometimes it can be quite profound, where the speech is, of course, becomes an impediment with speech, as well as normal tongue movement, certain, you know, chewing potential, and of course also, different functions that the tongue contributes to, including, for instance, even temporomandibular disorder or obstructive sleep apnea. Now, granted, when I mentioned those two, there's a lot of other variables that contribute to that as well.
Right.
But when the tongue has limited movement, you can only imagine that the neuromuscular response or the neurological aspect wants to move that tongue, and yet it's tied. So just
okay.
Alone that, battle, if you will, between the systems can play a role, particularly in the presence of other variables that are there. So,
okay, so this is more of a medical condition.
Yes, it is.
Condition.
And
Okay.
Yes. Also, it's predominant. Is of course contributes a significant issue. For instance, during breastfeeding, infant stage. So, in that particular case, we can do laser or releasing the tie from the floor mouth by addressing that freedom, and it can be similarly done with laser techniques. And on lasers, the only other option was a scalpel, which was much more invasive, of course, and required anesthesia. And these days, with lasers, we can, even eliminate the need for anesthetic. So that a really wonderful contribution and discovery to, to a medical condition.
Yes, lasers are wonderful. We can do so much today with lasers. So we've talked a lot about dentistry and the technologies and some of the science. What can people do to maintain good, just simple ways to maintain good dental health to keep our mouth clean? I mean, what are some things that are just simple that we should be doing every day to have a healthy mouth?
Mm-hmm. So I mentioned some of these on our YouTube channels at DC Laser Dentist, as well as on our social media. But some of the things, of course, include an at-home regimen, which includes brushing. I support the science-based recommendations of brushing within 30 minutes rule, is what I call it. I also recommend certain rinses. I recommend an electrical toothbrush that is, for instance, the Oral-B. I also recommend that you see your dentist at least every 6 months, if not more frequently, depending on what type of stains and what type of calcifications you're presenting with. In addition to that, brushing your tongue is just as important as brushing your teeth. A lot of bacteria sit on the tongue and can multiply. So I tell my patients that the surface of your tongue predominantly has to be as pink as the tip of your tongue.
Oh, that's interesting. And don't some people have a very, a geographic tongue? Where it's a lot
yes,
harder
the
to
geographic
clean?
Tongue. Yes, the geographic tongue is a benign condition where the surface of the tongue actually is ever so changing much more rapidly. So therefore, when you look at the surface, it looks like a geography or a mapping of some sort. And of course, a couple of things to be remembered with condition. One is that those particular cases are much more susceptible to sensitivities to hot, spicy foods, as well as beware of temperature, sudden temperature changes, which can, of course, invoke an autoimmune response. The actual underlying condition is based on autoimmune. It's suspected to be, of course, autoimmune related. So just the notion to be away from the extremes, which would further exacerbate the immune response, is a wise thing to do. In terms of the bacterial, again, you're going to see the bacteria distribute along some areas and not so much on the others, and circular movements. And I recommend not using a toothpaste, but just using the toothbrush head with cold water, 2-3 circles, and then, of course, rinse and then repeat until the entire surface is gently pink. So it has to be done within a very safe, gentle way, and that's the most effective way, particularly for individuals who have strong gagging reflex, for instance.
And now you mentioned different oral rinses. What do you recommend?
So one of my favorite things is fluoride. The reason why is because it's actually, fluoride has gotten a lot of press for the past decade in that it really, makes her strong, which is true. But the other characteristic with which fluoride never really gets mentioned for is that it's actually a very gentle bacteriostatic. And what I mean by that, it gently kills bacteria in a very natural environmental way, friendly, if you will. So it's not rough. For instance, if we were to consider rinses that have alcohol based in them, like Listerine, for instance, that can range up to even 25% alcohol, it can have a massive impact on eradicating bacteria. But that's not our aim in our mouth. I mean, in our mouth, actually, we have over 1,000 different types of species of bacteria that we need. That's part of our gastrointestinal system where we start the metabolic process in the mouth. So we want the bacteria, but we want each kind at a particular concentration in a particular place. And so gentle natural systems tend to be much more effective, of course, in the medications or the synthetics that come in rinse form or toothpaste that reflect with that science tend to be more effective. And that is what I have been observed in clinic as well as in the science.
So what are your favorite brands that people can buy over the counter or even at their dentist office?
So one of my ACT is one of my favorites. I've used it for decades, of course, and whatever I'm recommending here is what I've always applied to myself and my family, and of course my patients. I also particularly, for instance, the demographics in our population are changing, and I think that some of the chemotherapy and radiation cancer treatments have, and even medications, for instance, contribute to a manifestation or a compromise in the quality and the quantity of saliva. And in this particular, for this particular condition, I really like a particular rinse from Spain. It's called Zerostrom that comes in multiple different delivery systems, from rinses to paste to tablets and other formulations, a gel, for instance, that really helps in a very friendly way revitalize the moisture of the mouth. And that's very important in cleaning the tooth surface, and it's very important as well as in maintaining right concentrations of bacteria as we go through our daily lifestyle choices.
And what is the name of this again?
Zerostrom. It's called
Zero.
So it's spelled Zerostrom, yes. Mm-hmm.
Zerostrom.
Correct.
Okay. And is that something that's available online, or is that available through an RX from the dentist?
I think we have it in our office. I actually, imported it quite a number of, years ago from Spain in my travels and collaborations with the European group. I don't know if it is over-the-counter, to tell you the truth. I know that over-the-counter, traditionally, there has been biotin. It has some track record for improvement in the feeling, but my patients who've used biotin, who use now Zerostrom, are very partial towards Zerostrom, and they report that the impact is much more profound than biotin. But that's not to say that biotin is not an appropriate product and it doesn't have positive effects, and so it should definitely be utilized. So the point I'm aiming here is that the overall phenotypic and pathology in our population is just changing. And whereas 10, 20 years ago, we as clinicians, of course, we saw very infrequently or frequently these particular presentations with lesions, sores, or even, for instance, the human papillomavirus, HPV, present in the mouth, or the herpes virus present in the mouth. And now it's much more common. And one of the worst.
So it's really important that we maintain our dental health at home, and also that we go see the dentist, every 3 months for a cleaning, would you recommend?
So I would, of course, the standard of care every 6 months for a healthy patient. But if, for instance, in the case of sports performance, the diet includes nutritional bars, which are more stickier and they do, they're more difficult to remove during brushing. Oftentimes, a 3 month or a 4 month frequency is recommended. Or, for instance, the metabolically, the calcifications are just deposit our tooth structure at a much increased rate, and for that reason, again, the removal at the right time before it actually allows for an impact into the gums as well as into the bone is appropriate.
And now what about probiotics? Aren't probiotics also good for your oral health?
Yes, I would think so. But with probiotics, we have to refer back to the toxicology component, and that is probiotics are incredibly effective. They are impactful. They have robusticity to their characteristics, and for that reason, one has to really know the impact and has to profile systemically that patient so that the results can be, of course, monitored and also calculated effectively. With probiotics, for that reason, a lot of care has to be given, particularly in individuals who have systemic conditions and also histories of surgeries and other invasive treatments like cancer, radiation therapies, for instance, liver disease, kidney failures, cardiovascular aspect. So, in a case of probiotic, the clinician has to be, in my professional opinion, quite involved, both from in the oral head and neck area as well as in the gastrointestinal discipline as well.
So it's very interdisciplinary between your gastroenterologist and your general practitioner and your dentist and your facial plastic surgeon, right?
Yes.
We're just about out of time, Dr. Kotka, and this has been extremely interesting. We've got a lot of great information. And for listeners that would like to get in touch with you, your website is dclaserdentist.com. And you do have several YouTubes online, correct? What is your YouTube?
Yes.
URL.
I believe it is at the YouTube is www.youtube.com/dentist. But if you should Google DC Laser Dentist and you go to the YouTube channel, you should find us readily. We have many videos there, as well as on social media. And our website is, as you mentioned, www.dclaserdentist.com.
And you also have been a contributor to New Beauty magazine, and so there's information online at www.newbeauty.com, and you can search for Dr. Kotka. She's got some great information in New Beauty as well. And thank you for listening to our show. Thank you again, Dr. Kotka, and wishing everyone a happy Valentine's Day. And if you've missed any episodes, they're available as podcasts on podbeam.com, on Blog Talk Radio, on Stitcher.com. You can also download and listen to them on iTunes. And you can follow me on Twitter and Facebook and Pinterest at NipTuckCoach. And if you have any questions, you can email me at info@NipTuckCoach. And remember, you only have one face and one body, so choose wisely. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you next week. And thank you for listening.
Thank you so much, Michelle, for having me on. It was been a
pleasure.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the NipTuck Coach Radio. Join us next week for another exciting program about the world of cosmetic surgery and beauty. To learn more about Michelle Garber, go to www.niptuckcoach.com. To consult with Michelle directly, call 415-494-7211.